Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is a show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is JJ Johnson, chef, author, and founder of Ingrained Hospitality here in New York City. Most recently, JJ was a chef in residence at Chef's Club, and before that, he was a chef at the Cecil and Mittens in Harlem, where he attracted international attention with a menu of Afro-Asian dishes. JJ is a James Beard Award-nominated chef and has been featured in Forbes as part of their annual 30 Under 30 list. This week, he and his mentor, the legendary restaurateur Alexander Smalls, released their first cookbook, Between Harlem and Heaven, featuring recipes inspired by JJ's travels through the African diaspora. JJ.
What up, what up?
Welcome to A Hungry Society.
Thank you for having me. Sorry I messed up the schedule. It's been crazy these days.
That's right.
Twins. People don't put stuff on my calendar.
So you are the first guest I've had where writing an intro for you was so hard.
Why?
Because you do everything.
I don't know if I really do everything. I'm like Chance the Rapper right now. Like, I'm on my own. There's like one person that works with me that really truly believes. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of fans out there that like keep me really going and supporters. So,
but it was hard to like try and put it into like
I think you did a wonderful job. Probably the best I've heard.
So it's funny you said Chance the Rapper, because I read that you want to be the Michael Jordan of the food world.
Yeah, when I say Jordan of the food world, or like LeBron or the Obama or Steph Curry, I'm talking about like impact, right? Mm-hmm. Like Jordan had the craziest impact still to this day, mm-hmm, through the youth. Like, it's not like Jordan, I'm not talking about Jordan coming down the lane scoring 42 on you. I'm talking about kids wake up and want to wear Jordans. And if you just look at that way of living, I want young children to be like, I could be a chef like JJ. Mm-hmm. Right? That it's a real career. I can go to my mom and say, I want to be like JJ. I want to be a chef. Mm-hmm. And their parents go, oh, that's cool. That's great. Versus kind of like proving to them that it's okay to be a chef, or you go against the grain of what your parents are saying and mm-hmm, you don't get those wishes because of your nationality or what happened, or your parents want them to you be better than what they were. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean by that saying. And Jordan has the longest life cycle besides like Diddy,
right,
who took what Harlem really looks like, dressed mm-hmm it up, put it out, and projected it. So that's the terminology of what I mean.
Mm-hmm. You said you can go to your parents and have and be like, I want to be a chef as a career. Didn't you do that with your mom? And her response was like,
yeah, my mom will never admit that to this day. We argue. Every time she listens, she calls me and I get cursed out. But no, truly, like my mom was, my parents are real blue collar family. Mm-hmm. Did you believe that when we grew up, or do you believe that now? No. But my mom was a kindergarten teacher in the Poconos. Mm-hmm. My dad commuted to New York from the Poconos because wow, he didn't want to pay for private school. So he was a bookkeeper for the Board of Ed. And they really made it work. Did I travel a lot as a kid? 100%. Did we eat fascinating food? 100%, because that was my family, not my mom. But when I truly went to my mom and say, hey, mom, because the mom was like, your mom's a gatekeeper. It's like, hey, mom, I want to be a chef. And I was super young. She kind of laughed and was like, okay. And you know, I have children now. So like you push that in your children's head, like, no, you're going to be great. You're going to be amazing. But you're going to be a politician, mm, or you're going to be a doctor.
Right.
You ain't going to be you're not going to be blue collar. Mm. Blue collar days is over. I worked really hard for you, and you're going right to figure this out.
That is it. The fact that she wasn't just like, no, absolutely not. Like, you can't do that. It's so important. Cause my mom did the same thing. Like, I told her I wanted to be a food writer at 10 or 11.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and she was like, all right, I don't know what that is, but we'll figure it out, like, together.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
And look at you now.
Yeah, it made all the difference.
I mean, I love it because we went to the same school. Mm-hmm. I never knew that. I read your first article. I was like, yo, who's this chick? And I DM'd you, like, yo, congratulations on the great work. Yeah. And it was just, like, refreshing for me as somebody, like, through the grind and the hustle and been in the industry through, and I consider myself, I was through the old world and myself helped creating the new world of style of managing in the restaurants. Your article at that time that I read, that first article that you wrote, which was your breakout, was super refreshing for me, and I think really refreshing for the industry.
Thank you. I hope so. Speaking of CIA, of the Culinaries to America,
the CIA,
we have to talk about the late Jefferson Evans, who was the first Black student to graduate.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, it's been, I'm getting emails and Facebook messages and people ask me, like, JJ, what can we do?
Right.
And I'm like, okay, I know who he is, mm-hmm. but I never worked for him.
Right.
But there are tons of people that have worked for him that should pay tribute to his legacy. And I can help you pay tribute to that legacy, mm-hmm. By talking about it now or bringing awareness to it. But tell me what you need, because he completely is due to that. Like, he's the reason why I was able to go there. Like, he broke right. down that barrier.
Right.
Right. And I remember when I went to culinary school, I can name all the African-American kids. And there was a great New York Times article about that, like 2012, about there was like 3% African-Americans that actually went through the Culinary Institute of America.
Right.
And when you go and you date back, we were the ones that were in the kitchen mm-hmm. before James Beard made it the shit.
Right. Right.
So he's due to, for somebody to pay that legacy and somebody just to write that article and tell you who he is and what he did and what he became. Mm-hmm. Many people don't know who he is because he really kept a cool, quiet life.
Yeah.
But he did break down a lot of barriers for the youth. And I know he's looking down saying he did his job and there's more to come.
Yeah. And we have to keep it moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, people ask me all the time, like, yo, you got this fire. And it's like, I've always had the fire. And everything I do, I have the fire. But it's really truly like, it's truly about the food. It's truly about what is needed to get done. I mean, I tell people all the time, like, and it's truly sad. But until I started cooking at the Cecil, what media wasn't writing about any African Americans, right?
Right.
They were writing about Marcus Samuelson. Mm-hmm. But in that gap wave before Marcus, they were writing about Patrick Clark. Mm-hmm. In between that, maybe Herb Wilson, Alexander Smalls, right? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we could count them.
Yeah.
But there was tons of guys and girls out there doing work. Leah Chase, mm-hmm. Edna Lewis. Like, it took Top Chef for people to know who Edna Lewis was.
That episode made me so upset. So they asked, they were in Charleston, right? It was that season, and they asked the chefs, you know, how many of you have heard of Edna Lewis? And maybe one or two.
I was supposed to be actually on that episode to judge.
What happened? Why weren't you there?
Alexander was there.
Oh, okay. But yeah, people did not know who Edna Lewis was.
And then she became a New York Times bestseller because so many people were buying her mm-hmm. book. So it just shows you that media does have a major influence on careers. Mm-hmm. Media can help. Media right. can bring awareness. And for us, that for African Americans or any people of color that's out there really working hard, it's like, hey, can you just come check me out? Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I always say Joshua Zersky, he is the man. Because he truly came to Harlem. Mm-hmm. He truly came to a restaurant that had some hype, but not a lot of hype. Mm-hmm. And when he came there, he really got it. Like, he saw that it was bigger than just the food. Like, the food was great. But when's the last time I seen a restaurant open in Harlem with a wine director and a beverage director ran by two powerful African-Americans, and the room is beautiful, and there's these $10,000 paintings on the walls, mm-hmm. and the drapes caught, like, you know, and they revived the famous jazz club, and mm-hmm. the sign went down to the African-American Museum. There's, like, all these steps that went into the process than right. just a restaurant opening. That happens every day. So, you know, my hat is always tipped to Mr. Ozersky, because without him, I'm not sure I'll be here sitting next to you.
So can you take me back to when you started getting that media attention? Like, how did that feel like at that point in your career as a chef?
I mean, how did it feel? It felt surreal, like unreal. Mm-hmm. It felt like it was the moment that you were like watching Emeril Lagasse on television. He was like, bam.
Yeah.
And the article came. If I could put it in like that retrospect, like in the first people, I mean, Joshua Davidson and Joshua Zersky will argue about who wrote about me, who wrote about us first, who mm-hmm. wrote about me first. So I love them. I love Joshua Davidson. I love Josh Zersky. But then after that, you know, Forbes was really like the true like pivotal moment of like co-signed to who I was and what I was doing. And you know, they're all about people that are going against the grain.
Yeah.
Like, think about who they're writing about. Like, yesterday, cover was Bitcom. Like, nobody's even looked that way, right? Now everybody today is piggybacking off of that.
Right.
So it was an amazing feeling. And at that time, it was like, wow, I'm cooking the food of who I am and the food that I believe in, and people are writing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not cooking French food or Italian food or New American, mm-hmm. and somebody's writing about me, and it happens to taste really good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thankful every day, thankful for all the support. And I think it really helped. I think it really helped shape America or even the world about who was cooking next and what they were doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we were cooking the food of the African diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was using the word, or diaspora, however you want to say it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was using that word. We were using that word. Next thing you know, people were saying, my God, I'm cooking the food of the Korean diaspora. I'm cooking the food mm-hmm. of the Chinese diaspora, the Vietnamese diaspora. And that was like the real movement. It wasn't just about being black and being proud and doing what you wanted to do. It was like opening the doors for the next young woman or next young man to say, I can do the same thing, and this is who I am,
and continue to tell the story.
Right.
So you said in interviews that it took you a while to get to the style of cooking that you do and the dishes that you do. Like, at first you were doing hard. Yeah, like Italian food and French food, and you had to like find your way to the food that.
Yeah, you know, like I got this email from Alexander Smalls, and he was saying he wanted to meet me for breakfast, and I'll talk to anybody. I mean, anybody. And then I met with him. He talked about Afro-Asian American cooking or food of the African diaspora. And I'm like, what are you talking about, bro? And it's a true statement. And I did my research. And I couldn't really find anything. And my mom, being a school teacher, was like, hey, pick up the encyclopedia. Maybe it can help you along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up going to Ghana. And when we went to Ghana to cook in 2011, I was just there to do these American themed dinners. But that's when I was cooking around these West Africans, and the light bulb effect happened. Was like, I know that scent. I know what that is. Mm-hmm. And I found myself. I found out who I was and what I was supposed to do in life.
Mm-hmm.
And most people go to West Africa and they go to slave castles and they find themselves that way. But I found myself through the food there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh my goodness, I'm the kid of the African diaspora. Why hasn't anybody told me this shit? Mm. Like, what's going on?
Right.
Like, why did my mom tell me I'm made up of all these people through slave
mm-hmm.
trade, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through forced migration. But it took that moment of being there. And then when I came back, I started pulling from who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And when I mean who I was, my African-American dad, my West Indian mom, my West Indian Puerto Rican mother,
mm-hmm.
pulling back through that and pulling out those food that I knew and food that I didn't know, and started studying the Afro ports of the world.
Mm-hmm. And I don't remember a class at CIA that
talked
about that at all.
Me and Tim Ryan talk about this all the time.
I mean, It's long overdue.
What do we, the most cultural class at CIA is Chinese cookery.
Right.
And one day you do Chinese, one day you do Vietnamese, one day you do Indian, one day you do Korean, right? But
Japanese.
Not knowing that Chinese food, you have Northern Chinese, Southern Chinese, like all these different, knowing that you have Filipino, like all these things that people are cooking today that you're just learning the basic of Italian and French cuisine. And I'm not throwing any shade that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying there's much more to food than that.
Definitely.
And I think, you know, coming out with the cookbook Between Harlem and Heaven is a true pedestal. the true moment of there's something else. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that there's no other books on the shelf that represent the food of the African diaspora, mm-hmm. but there's no books on the shelves that actually talk about the African diaspora, and then there's recipes that go alongside of it. Mm-hmm. This is something that I will compare, and I will tell anybody, this is the Marcus Samuelson Aquavie book. Mm-hmm. This is the Thomas Keller French Laundry book. Mm-hmm. This is the... Give me something else. What was on our CIA reading, right?
Ooh, the Professional Chef.
This is the Professional Chef. This is giving you the foundation of a new style of food or old style of food that nobody was talking about. Mm-hmm. And it gives you the foundation to understand what the true food of the African diaspora is. And people that look like me or people that want to cook the food I cook can actually say, I have something now. I have the Bible. Mm-hmm. And now I can move the needle.
Is that what you started out with, like, the intention of doing when you decided to write your book? No, or did it just kind of naturally happen?
You know, this book took 2 years. Veronica Chambers really pulled this book amazingly together. She wrote 32 Yokes for Eric Repair. She wrote Marcus's Yes Chef. We sat together a lot of days and nights and pulled some stuff together, essays mm-hmm. and things that are in this book. I'm not sure that I... You know, when you want to do something in your mind, you think you're doing one thing, but you're actually doing something else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the key to me for this book was, like, people might think I'm crazy, but, like, this is not a book for the chef. This is the book for, like, everyday people. And mm-hmm. The chef is the everyday person. And the chef uses cookbooks as reference guides.
Right.
And this book is there for them as a reference guide to understand, to get it, to realize, to build their pantry, to do these things. Veronica put the book together that way. Mm-hmm. She must have understood what I was saying when I was speaking to her mm-hmm. or when Alexander was writing his Silk Road Path, that's what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And that's truly what it is. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's 300 pages and... There's 100 recipes, and the photographer got it, the food stylist mm-hmm. got it, the editor got it, the president mm-hmm. of the Flatiron got it. It is just truly special, and I hope that the world sees it the same way.
Mm-hmm. So you just finished a really successful residency at Chef's Club. If you're listening and you didn't get a chance to go, it was Chef's
you
Club.
Out.
Yeah, you missed out, and... Chef's Club is a restaurant where they have a different chef come in. And originally you were only supposed to do, what, like a month or so?
I was only supposed to do 30 days.
Yeah. And it was so popular that they extended it through the rest of 2017.
Yeah, it was crazy. I got to piggyback and sash you. When you say successful, what do you mean? What do you mean by successful? Like, what's your successful?
It was really well received. I never heard a bad thing about your residency at Chef's Club. Like, just from word of mouth talking to people.
That's great to know. Thank you,
and
everybody.
And you also got this, like...
Crazy this, profile
yeah,
piece in the Times.
This, like, beautiful profile piece on the front page of the food section of the New York Times.
So, yeah, let's say two steps back. So, I left the Cecil and Minton's in June. Mm-hmm. It was just time for me to go. My time was up there. I felt like I did my justice. And to go out on my own, you know, Aaron, who does the books of chefs at Chef's Club, mm-hmm. I thank him every day for going out and saying, yo, this is the guy, he's got you, don't worry. And, you know, Aaron helped me write menus there. The team at Chef's Club was truly amazing. Stefan, the president of Chef's Club, believed in me, not knowing what I could do before I could do it. But remember, I took over Chef's Club counter first mm-hmm. for the first guy to ever take over Chef's Club counter. To test my rice concept, and it went really well. Mm-hmm. We had like a 500-person wait list. Wow. And then from there, they said, do you want to take over Chef's Club? And I was kind of like, I don't really want to do full-service restaurants at this moment. Mm-hmm. And Aaron goes, yo, what you used to do at the Cecil was truly special.
Right.
Cecil hasn't been around for a year. Mm-hmm. What's up? Like, why don't you bring back some of those dishes people always ask you for. Mm-hmm. And it was like a great conversation. Like, why don't you bring back some of these dishes that you kind of took off the menu that people loved or still ask you about when you travel the country and cook? And then why don't you do some things like you've traveled the world mm-hmm. in these last 5 years to these crazy places. Like, I cooked in Israel. I was in Singapore. I was in India. And, like, really give us some of that and give us, you know, what's your interpretation of now what the African diaspora is with these Asian cooking notes. So we rocked out a 16-item menu, and it was a truly major hit. Samantha Davis, who's my, I'm gonna upgrade Samantha today. She's in Paris, but she's not listening. like a true culinary director, like she, after she was done with me at Chef's Club, she literally knows who I am. Like, we can go anywhere and cook, and when we cook for the Grammys, like she already knew what it was. Like, no, we're gonna do this, and you're gonna be quiet, and I know you wanna add this and this, but you better show me how you want that, because I don't know.
I mean, speaking of people who don't get enough attention,
right.
She's
truly like genius on like a totally different culinary level. And when I mean that, like her organizational skills, the way she can do food costs, like she's a true, she's a true team member that everybody should look for when they're building their career. So, but yeah, I mean, Chef's Club was great. And I think the greatest thing for me at Chef's Club is I used to talk to people as I was like out on my own raising money or trying to get hotel deals or still trying to get hotel deals. Mm-hmm. They would say, well, you're just in Harlem.
What?
You need to, I don't know how you would do downtown. And I was like, bro, I used to work at Tribeca Grill. Yeah. I opened up the First Smith. What you talking about? Like, these are successful places. And I was just best restaurant of the year, and we used to do like crazy. What are you saying? Like, I'm still in Manhattan. Harlem is Manhattan. It's not its own borough.
Right.
Brooklyn is its own borough. What's going on?
That's crazy.
So for me, it was like proving something, but it became more than that because people that would never come to Harlem, those are the same people that never came to see me at Chef's Club.
Mm.
And I'm talking about like food media. Like people that would say, yo, I don't know, JJ, Harlem's like, it's easier to get to Chicago than it is to get to Harlem.
Who said that?
Well, they know who they are. They're listening. And but then when I came to Chef's Club and they never came, or when I got a New York Times profile piece and they never came,
right.
I started to say, okay, the people who I mess with is the people that mess with me.
Right.
You know? So to see like Jeff Gournier come through or Clancy come through or the ex-publisher from Food & Wine, Christina Gronovinsky, come through, you know, like, that meant a lot to me, you know? Or the Times, like, the first time to be out on your own and the Times writes a profile piece about you. I said to them on the phone when they called me, you sure you want to write about me? There's so many great chefs out here, like, you can write about. And they broke it down in a way that made total sense. It was like, we have to write about you, which you've been doing with the Food of the African Diaspora. Now is starting to impact the world, and you're starting to see all this Afro this and Afro that, right? You're seeing Afro-Asian in London now. You're seeing Afro-Caribbean in D.C. You're seeing Afro-Chinese now. I'm seeing Afro-Coke in Australia. Like, they were naming places I never even heard about.
Right.
And I said, okay, let's do this. And I truly appreciate the New York Times for doing that. And that all because it's all because of one person, Aaron at Chef's Club, believing in me. And then the rest of the people believing in the food, and that's in Stefan and Kim and Constant and Yasmin and Ashley and all those guys there and girls there that were like, yo, we got your back and we're gonna make this pop.
Well, I'm sad that it's not there anymore. Because it was like this great snapshot of not just where you're at as a chef, but also like just you, there were all kinds of people in that dining room every night.
Yeah, it's crazy because like when I go to investor meetings now, they're like, so what's your demographic? And I'm like, it's everybody. And like, what do you mean it's everybody? I'm like, no, I truly like, I get African Americans, I get Latinos, I get Asians, I get white males, I get white women, I get young white males, I get young white men, I get people coming from Sweden. I get people from Australia and London. They're like, we never heard that before. You're making it up. And it's like, no, like you really,
like,
truly.
Like, actually, this is happening in the dining room.
Right? And then when I took over Spring Play Studios, the member club for Grammys week, the same thing happened there with their members. I mean, like The Dream was in the dining room and Jason Wu and like all these great people were coming that never were coming there before. And it made them open their eyes there too, saying, I never knew we had such a diverse members club. Or I never knew our members were so diverse.
Right.
And I think that's truly what I do with food, is that I really am cooking the food of the melting pots of the world, or the true melting pot of the world, which is the African diaspora. And it truly is connecting people that I never thought they would connect before or didn't realize they were really connected.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about your next steps, like next things that you're working on?
I'm working hard over here.
You are always rushing around.
I came through here and ran through Roberta and stumbled on the step and looking for my pizza. Where's my pizza at? And no, I mean, I'm working. You know, my next step right now is I'm raising money for Rice Concept. Mm-hmm. So when I mean a Rice Concept, I mean instead of a noodle ramen noodle bar, I mean a rice bar. Mm-hmm. I can't drop those dimes yet till it's opened. I'm about 80% there raising funds. I need another about 20-25%, which is a little harder than I expected, especially mm-hmm. coming off my Chef's Club run. I figured that somebody would call me and say, "Hey JJ, we got you. We believe in you
right.
now."
Right.
Or I would get one of these great kitchen like management deals in a hotel for what I did at Chef's Club, but that's why I say I'm on my Chance to Rapper stuff because right. he won a Grammy without being on a label. So
right.
that's my vision or who I have to channel.
That's so crazy to me that that's it's been tough to attract investors.
Yeah, it's interesting. And maybe I'm not doing it right because that's one. Maybe that's what the Culinary Institute needs to put in place, like how to raise money
right?
properly. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I got my bachelor's degree there, but yeah, we wrote a business plan. But what do you say to investors? What do your emails look like? You mm-hmm. know, all these things. So, yeah, I'm going to get it, though. Mm-hmm. We're going to get there.
I feel like we've come up with like a curriculum just in this conversation for CIA. Where is Tim Ryan? I hope he's listening to this.
Tim's a great supporter, though. So, I know I give him a lot of shit time to time, but I could do that because I pay Sally. Right. I'm still paying Sally Mae, so I know
yep.
you are.
Yep.
But I think Tim is getting it. He's just trying to figure out how to do it now.
Right.
And we've had that conversation, and I think it's coming. It's not coming soon, but it's gonna come.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that look like? He's trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Hungry Society and Chef JJ.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
We're back with Chef J.J. Johnson of Between Harlem and Heaven, his new cookbook. We're talking about everything from culinary school to food and dating.
Who we know.
Off the record.
And how they know us.
So growing up, did you guys go out to eat a lot?
Yeah, you know, growing up, my mom's sister, her only sister, which traveled really well.
Mm-hmm.
She used to work at New York Presbyterian. She did very well for herself. And her husband, my uncle, who I spent a lot of time in the kitchen with, was from Virginia, and he used to have a crab boat.
Mm.
So when crab season was in, we used to have all this crab meat come.
Did you ever go down there?
Not that I think I did, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But we there was always like the crab cake battle, crab fondue, this crab, that crab. Mm. And they were the ones that really took me out to eat at restaurants. Like, I remember eating escargot and not knowing what escargot was. Mm-hmm. I remember going to eat at restaurants that probably cost a ton of money, but they didn't have kids at that time, and it was just me and them. Mm-hmm. But they knew I loved food, so it was, like, that moment. My mom and my dad weren't, like, big eaters in that regard. Mm-hmm. So they were the ones that kind of pushed that needle. And when you look back, you're like, who played a role into everything that you do today? And Uncle Donald definitely was a good role of that in making me successful and opening my eyes into foods. I remember him making me eat clams on the half shell without putting hot sauce on it the first time. He was like, you need to know what this tastes like. And I'm like, bro, I'm 14. Right. I see you guys putting hot sauce. Why can't I get hot sauce on this? And then waiting for me to finish my clam on the half shell. And then, so that was like my first experience. And I'm seeing it right now with his father in the room, my parents laughing. But those things that would shape me as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what like a lot of people forget is like, everybody's households have these moments that shape you through food and these nostalgic moments. And I think that's what helps me cook today and what I do.
All right. And now you have children.
Yes, I have twins.
Are you going to make them eat clams?
Oh, they're eating now. I think my wife thinks they're eating just squash, but they're eating calabaza squash because that's what's in season. Mm-hmm. So they're on their fourth food group.
Do you make their food?
Right now I do, yeah. So they had, what did they have? They had bananas, sweet potato, squash, and apples start tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And eventually they'll get into the...
Oh, we're going to get wild. I mean, when they go out to eat with me, it's really funny. Like, if they're 6 months old, so when they're strapped, when one's strapped to my chest and I'm eating, they always have food in their hair. Mm-hmm. And my wife's like, oh, this is ridiculous. Like, I'm like, they're perfectly fine.
They're fine.
They'll be okay.
Yeah, and you got to get them used to restaurants.
Oh, they're great in restaurants, knock on wood. We go to Melba's on Sunday for our brunch because I live in Harlem. Mm-hmm. We do a couple other places. I think I had one moment at a sushi restaurant where I had to take my daughter out and was like, you will stop crying. I don't know why you are crying right now.
She's but 6 months old.
We're not going to be those people.
She wasn't like, okay.
And some lady was walking by like, oh, you having your first baby cry moment in a restaurant?
Is that your favorite restaurant at the moment? Or do you have any favorites that you go to?
It's interesting because, you know, I'm so used to like getting on the train and going. I haven't taken my children on the train yet.
Oh, wow.
We've been eating really like locally around where I live. It's been hard. Mm-hmm. That's when people talk about neighborhood restaurants. Like, where can you go on a consistent base and get what you need?
Right.
I feel like that's what Harlem needs. It needs something neighborhoody. You can go every day. When I mean neighborhood, like, you get a glass of wine, an app, an entree, and it's like about $45. You don't spend more than $100. Mm. Or it's neighborhoody because it's like grab and go and you spend $22 and you're able to eat in there and it's really good and you can go back 2-3 times a week. So I'm always thinking about what that is and how I can help out in that area, in that community.
Yeah. So something I've noticed with food media, I feel like Harlem has been co-opted a little bit. Like food media likes to do a roundup or interview one person. And that kind of, they're like checking a box almost.
For
Do you know
Harlem?
What I mean?
I know what you mean, but I mean, Harlem is tough. Like, I was talking about this with somebody this morning, and they were like, you know, when people come in and they, what's this word when you change a community?
Gentrify?
Gentrify it. Mm-hmm. Like, Brooklyn got gentrified really quick, and I think it caught African Americans off guard. Mm-hmm. Where what Harlem is like, when you think of Harlem, it's like black excellence. And people, when they thought they were going to be able to gentrify it, African-Americans in that community, Puerto Ricans in that community, West Africans in that community, started buying brownstones, started buying those apartments. Mm-hmm. And I think landlords have put a halt on a lot of things of how to progress that community because they can't progress it in the way they want to. Mm. So I would say Harlem is down about 30%, but I'm not sure. I mean, where would you write about in Harlem right now? Cecil Steakhouse?
I don't know. Well, do you think food media does Harlem justice?
I don't think food media goes through to Harlem. Again, I go back. I think they think it's too far, so they don't really go up there. Mm. If they did go up there, they would find, like, on 124th Street, there's a great new Jamaican spot that's, like, decor is amazing. If they did go up there, they would see this place called Harlem Nights that has great music on Thursdays. If they did go up there, they would know that there's a hand-pulled noodle shop on 145th Street. Like, people think Harlem is just from 110th to 125th Street on Lenox. Harlem goes from 110, well, really back in the day, from 96th Street, from 96th Street, West End, all the way to First Avenue, and all the way up to the Polo Grounds, right before you get to Washington Heights. So, like, 140s and Broadway have some great restaurants that are doing, that's part of Harlem, that you can get great Chinese hand-pulled noodles. There's great bars up that way. So I think people miss out on exploring the full Harlem, that they're just so caught up on 125th Street thinking that's Harlem. Now, hey, go to Harlem. They just opened up a Gucci store.
A Gucci store?
Or Dan the Dapper.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I saw the billboards for that. Would you ever live in another neighborhood in New York? Or are you committed to staying in Harlem? You know, I'm just curious.
That's... When I was a kid, I always wanted to live in Tribeca. The apartments were so big. It's like lofty. You feel like you're in the movies. It's truly like something special. So Tribeca always has my heart slightly, and that's the first New York City restaurant I ever worked in. What other neighborhood?
I've actually been spending a bit of time in Tribeca lately.
Listen, Tribeca.
The story, the Odeon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Doing a little.
Legendary.
Yeah, doing a piece on.
That's great.
Chef Clark. So yeah, Tribeca's a cool neighborhood.
Great neighborhood. And back then, that was the, remember, that was a neighborhood nobody went to.
Yeah.
Drew Nupron opened up, crushed it. Then everybody was fluttering in. Now it's kind of going back to the old days where it's more residential. But that's where people ate. I mean, when I cooked that Tribeca grill, I mean, everybody was, I mean, I remember cooking when Puffy was there and they told me I couldn't plate his food. They were like, you're new.
Yeah.
And you will step to the side.
They were like, okay, sit down.
Sit down on we got this.
Take me back to those days of when you were starting out. What's like the biggest difference between then and now as a chef? A cook.
Back then, you were a cook. You worried about your station.
Mm-hmm.
You set it up. You put out the best possible food on your station. You didn't care about nobody else. And you got it done.
Do you miss that sometimes?
I mean, I'm a line cook at heart, regardless. Yeah. Like, if you work with me, I tell all my cooks all the time, like, hey, you want to walk out right now? I don't care. I'll work your station. And they think I'm crazy. Like, okay, JJ, we see you hugging and taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, my heart and my soul is always in the pots and the pans. Like, that's what keeps people coming to the restaurant. Like, the food is what makes people want to take pictures with me. Like, it's not the, because I have a good haircut. Like, that's what it is. So, yeah, I mean, I worked at Tribeca Grill, and it was a busy kitchen. We were doing, like, 620 people a night. Everybody and anybody was coming through there. I remember Bruce Springsteen used to come through the back, through the kitchen, and come to the dining room. And that was like my real moment of like, ooh, Stephen Lewandowski just took over the kitchen. He was like 26 years old. I was 17. And I was like, okay, when I grow up, I want to be like this guy. This is who I want to be. And he was like a single dude. He was in his peak. His sous chef was Michael. And they used to like really rock out. And you would, Stephen would close and you would come back in the morning because I would come back early because I was so slow. They would tell me I needed to come back early, make sure my station was set up. And he would be in there skimming stocks.
Damn.
And I was like, hey, man, why are you here? I'm like, chef, why are you here so early? He's like, listen, there's one thing I'm going to control in this restaurant. It's going to be the sauces. It's going to be the stocks. I'm a saucier at heart. And I always paid attention to that because, like, you finish the dish with the sauce. There's the stocks are building a building platform.
Right.
So, you know, Steven was great at that young age, and now he has, like, 10 restaurants in Connecticut, and he's crushing it. And Michael is his culinary director. Oh, it took him with him. And then from there, I went back to CIA. get my bachelor's. I promised my mom would get my bachelor's. Now I owe Sally Mae more money. A chef told me before I left from CIA that he didn't want me to take a line cook position, that he said that I need to take a junior sous position. You're in a junior sous position, you'll still work the line, mm-hmm. but you'll start to manage. And if you take a line cook position, you're going to be stuck.
Right.
I was like, okay. So I couldn't find a junior sous position. I took a management training program. Nobody knows this at Wegmans.
Mm.
I hated it. I used to commute from my parents' house there. And at that time...
What, in the Poconos?
Poconos to South Jersey. Mm. And at that time, you know, they was popping with the prepared foods. And I'm like, nobody wants prepared foods.
Right.
Nobody wants this. What are you talking about? Nobody wants to come get chicken that has been pre-roasted and... Mm. In a pan.
That's so like opposite of your cooking. I can't imagine you running like a prepared foods like program.
So I was in management training and I quit. I think the chef at that time was like mad at me because I quit. I wish I would remember his name. I would send him a book. And because you run into guys like this, and I know cooks have run in, there's cooks that probably ran through me and mm-hmm. that will grow up and be super successful. Like, I can't wait till I see JJ. Because you just have those moments. Like, you're going to clash with people. It's real life. And I was on Craigslist and I saw a job for Jane. Mm-hmm. But I worked for this dude, this sous chef in Pennsylvania at a place called Sky Top Lodge when I was young and would come home. He was like, you'll never take a job that a place that you never eat in. So eat there first, see if you like the food, and then go from there. So I ate there. I liked the food. I went on an interview. The executive sous chef, I was in his, we graduated together. Mm-hmm. It felt like home. Jane was amazing. Brian Ellis, the man this day, executive corporate chef of the Smith Corner Social Restaurant Group, said to me, hey, we're about to open up this restaurant. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot of things thrown at you, but I need you to like work on these recipes, manage, do mm-hmm. this, do that, blah, blah, blah. So... I worked the line there 4 nights a week. My first night there, I burned my hand because owner Glenn was in that night. And I had to work through that. And then we tested recipes for the Smith. I helped them open up that spot. And then I became the executive sous chef at Jane. Fast forward, I was there for 3 years. I went mm-hmm. to go work for Leah Cohen at Centro Vinoteca. She left to go travel for the Southeast Asian, which now she has Pig and Cow, and she's crushing it.
And Piggyback Bar in Jersey City.
Leah came up.
Yeah.
Real quick lately. Yeah.
Speaking of up.
That's the home. That's the true homie. I have a lot of love for Leah.
Fellow grad, too.
Yep. But, you know, Pig and Cow is an amazing restaurant, so we work together. And again, we didn't see eye to eye on everything. Some things in my technique she didn't like, and she mm-hmm. molded me. And then that restaurant was closing, and I went to go work at Morgan Stanley Executive Dining Room, which mm-hmm. I called the Secret Kitchen. I worked for a gentleman named Zach Friedman, mm-hmm. and he worked at Chanterelle, 11 Madison Park, all these great restaurants. He just had a kid, so he went corporate dining. But we change our menu every day. So I was working with Hind Quarters, Four Quarters, Mangalisa. That's when Nyman first hit the market. That's when Schooner Bay first hit the market. Like, mm-hmm. we were really working with everything luxurious and great. And I stayed there for 3 years, and then I just missed the kitchen. But I couldn't find somebody to believe in me. Mm. So I went on a cooking show in Rocco's Dinner Party, and that's when Alexander Small saw me. And then I helped open up the Cecil, mm-hmm. Brick by brick. And then now I'm here on my own with a cookbook called Between Harlem and Heaven.
Now you have a cookbook. It's an incredible, incredible story. So I have questions that I ask every guest without naming names.
You did send me those. I didn't read them, though.
JJ, what? Okay, without naming names, or you can name them if you want to, can you talk about the worst dining experience you've ever had?
I try not to remember the worst dining experiences I ever have.
Okay.
I know they're there,
mm-hmm.
and I hate them. And I try to just, I'm all about the good vibes. So I try to just wash them out. But they're there. They might come back to me at the end of this now.
So if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who's invited?
I mean, of course, President Barack and Michelle are invited.
Yep.
I would say my Puerto Rican grandmother, because I would always want her to taste my cooking. Mm-hmm. I can invite anybody?
Anybody.
My mom, my dad, my sister, my wife, my twins, Michelle Obama, President Barack Obama, Leah Chase, my grandmother, both of them that are deceased. You'll be there.
Thanks.
Chef Fry from the CIA.
Oh, Chef Fry. Oh, my God. Was that Skills 1 that he taught?
Skills 1.
Yeah.
And we would be, I envision like this super long table outside, smelling green grass just before it hits fall. Everybody's drinking, starting off with rosé and working our ways into old fashions. The food is served family style. It's everything from the African diaspora. Everybody can bring a friend if they want to. Mm-hmm. And then after the dinner's over, it turns into a party and all my friends are invited. If you know me, then you know that that's real.
And it's still outside in the grass?
It's definitely outside. And
wait, what are we drinking at the party?
At the party, we keep them with the old fashions and the champagne flowing. And who's DJing? Who's in 90s hip hop and R&B is playing?
Yeah. I think your playlist from Chef's Club.
Epic.
Yeah. I think that would be good music. Well, that's the end of the show. JJ, I could talk
it's
to you
over
for
already?
I know.
Goodness.
I could talk to you
gracious.
For hours about all of this stuff, but congrats on all of your success.
Thank you very much.
There's so much more to come.
From your ears, from your mouth to God's ears.
And thank you so much for listening. I'll catch you next week on The Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.